Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of considerable intelligence, which he is thankfully helping to pass along to graduate students at the Institute of World Politics, where he's a research professor, and also at Sancerre, the French military academy, where he is also a visiting professor, and to many, many more of us through his work as a contributing editor of Providence, the Journal of Christianity and American Foreign Policy. His name is Dr. Paul Coyer. He's a good friend, and we're always glad to have him with us, especially as he has just returned from a fact-finding mission to Iraq. And I'm anxious to hear what he has found there, specifically with respect to the plight of Christians who have been suffering tremendously for many years and are in rather desperate straits now, I understand. Paul, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for joining us, and welcome home.
Very glad to be here. Thank you very much.
I'm interested in kind of a sit rep, as they say, a situation report. How would you characterize the condition at the moment of what was once a very large and thriving population of Christians in Iraq?
Well, as you heard me say the other day in a meeting that you and I were both in, I think the single word that most encapsulates this is depressing. A lot of your listeners will already know these stats, but just 10-second version is in 2003, there are 1.5 to 1.6 million Christians in Iraq. Today, there is approximately 150,000, maybe as many as two, but probably less than that. So in other words, we've lost 90% of the population in 15 years.
And when you say lost, they didn't just get misplaced. Where are they?
Exactly. They didn't just goof into the ether. No, they weren't lost in that sense. There's a result of genocide, and that predates ISIS. ISIS was part of it, but long before ISIS, a good 10 years and more before ISIS, frankly, it goes back many generations. If you know the history, it looks bad.
And sadly, even though ISIS is pretty much done, as best we can tell, the kind of animus that it epitomized, it's continuing to operate there, as I understand it. What are you finding in that regard?
Well, it's interesting. I spoke with a number of Christians of all stripes, of all ranks, from teenagers to millennials to bishops and priests, and many of them said the same thing. Now, I have, as I'm sure you do, Frank, I have friends who are well-meaning Muslims who are liberally minded in the classically liberal sense that would be horrified at hearing this. But what I heard consistently over there was that when ISIS came in, the type of virulence that they injected into the Muslim populace, it was like a virus. And you would have Muslim neighbors that had lived next to a Christian family for 30 years, and the Christian family thought their Muslim neighbors were their close friends. And those neighbors would hear that the ISIS, the Islamic State caliph, would say, "We're coming to your town next, all Muslims. I'm calling on you to you tell your neighbors, your Christian neighbors, they have 48 hours to either leave their homes or you have the legal right to kill them and take their homes." And these Muslim neighbors would knock on the Christian doors. This happened to the family of a close friend of mine who relayed the story to me and say, "By the way, the caliph has said we have the right to take your home. You have 48 hours. I suggest you leave within 24. And the neighbors thought they were joking because they were such close friends, so they thought. 24 hours later, the same Muslim neighbor came back, knocked on the door, and said, "Now you've got 24 hours, you need to get out of Dodge." And finally realizing that they were serious and horrified by this, the Christian neighbors did what they thought was the Christian thing. They didn't argue, they turned the other cheek, they went next door, they packed, went next door with the keys, handed the keys to their neighbors, and said, "I thought we were close friends. In fact, I thought we were like cousins. I'm shocked and horrified by your behavior. Nevertheless, in the love of Christ, here are the keys to our house. You have it with our blessing." And they left. The problem is, how do you rebuild trust and any sense of security for any Christians that have left a situation in that manner to want to come back and trust their Muslim neighbors? And so repeatedly I heard Iraqi Christians say, we cannot trust our Muslim neighbors. There are some good ones. We're aware of that. The problem is we had people that we thought were, quote unquote, the good ones, who suddenly turned on us as soon as they saw ISIS coming.
And it raises a whole set of questions about whether they can return to those communities, let alone do so safely. And Paul, I wanted you to sort of elaborate for our audience some of your findings about the importance of helping them secure themselves and what needs to be done in that regard.
Repeatedly, I heard from people, Christianity will be gone within a generation from Iraq, if not sooner. These are from Iraqi Christians. The only thing that will slow our emigration and or stop us would be if we have some sort of ability to provide for our own security. Right now, analysts disagree, but there are somewhere between 60 and 120 different private militias. Now, private, isn't they're not really private. Technically, they kind of come underneath the Iraqi prime minister's office in a legal framework that they were brought in on in 2014 to help the Iraqi government fight ISIS when the Iraqi army was just completely falling away. These are called popular mobilization units, or PMUs. The vast majority of those PMUs are Muslim PMUs. There are six Christian ones, and they are outnumbered by many times to one by Shia militias. Hostel Shaabi is a big part of that, funded by Tehran. Having your security checkpoints in the roads surrounding your village and the entry into your village as a Christian, sometimes controlled by these Shia and sometimes Sunni militias, doesn't give you a sense of security, especially given the recent history. So we need to enable these guys to secure those checkpoints and those villages themselves. So the Nineveh Plains Protection Units, for instance, have 500 people. That's it. For the whole of Nineveh Plains, that's minuscule. And they're outnumbered exponentially by these Muslim militias.
And as you say, some of these are backed by Iran, which has its own agenda. Somebody was explaining to me just yesterday that there's an ambition of the Iranians to run roads right through this area in Nineveh to fulfill their carving out of this so-called Shiite crescent heading up to Syria, Lebanon, and the Mediterranean in close proximity to Israel, indeed. This adds urgency, obviously, to helping the Christians stay in place and provide something of a counterweight to all of this. I understand that you found that there was considerable, you used a different word for it, but despair seems to me to be in order here, yeah, about the help that they're getting, or I should put more accurately, not getting, from Christian co-religionists in this country. As you know, we are part of an effort to try to do something about that under the rubric of something called the Save the Persecuted Christians Coalition and Campaign. And what more can be done in terms of help from organizations and teams like ours?
Number one, putting money where our mouth is. I heard repeatedly from the Christian leaders over there, we don't mean to be rude to you. We're sure that you and your team are well-meaning, but we are so tired of seeing American and Western in general Christians come here and talk to us and say nice words and then not do squat, bluntly. So they're saying, if you're going to come and talk to us, don't just do photo ops, don't just post on Twitter, do something. Now, the something they want is they need money. They desperately need money.
Paul Coyer, thank you so much for joining us. Come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of our duty experts and, well, America's on matters involving national security and the law, among other topics. He is Hans von Spakovsky. These days, he is a senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He brings to it a lot of life experience, including as a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in the Justice Department, and also service as a member of the Federal Elections Commission. He is an author and co-author, notably with John Fund, of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Hans, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
The
subjects that I want to cover with you are exhaustive, and we won't get anywhere near doing justice to any of them, but quickly to move through a couple of the most important. Yesterday, there was a lot of high drama, I think one might even say fireworks, on the House Judiciary Committee dais as they took testimony from the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, and the FBI Director, Christopher Wray. Give us a sense of what went on and why it was significant.
Well, there were a lot of questions that, very good questions, that were being asked by the members of the committee that Wray and Rosenstein just kind of danced around and obviously didn't want to answer. And the best example of that was when Louis Gohmert, a congressman from Texas, was asking Rosenstein about the fact that, you know, he as the number two DOJ official, had signed off on and approved the fourth application for a electronic surveillance warrant from the secret FISA court. And Louis Gohmert was asking him, did you actually read this? And Rosenstein's answer was, well, I approved it. And they got into this tussle where it was pretty obvious that Rosenstein didn't want to admit that he didn't read it.
It was one of the more exhilarating examples of this. You're right. Jim Jordan, a congressman from Ohio, also had a very important line of questioning in which he was trying to ascertain what Rosenstein knew about some of the activities that would clearly create a conflict of interest and require a recusal by him from some of these pieces of the investigation into so-called collusion by the Trump campaign. Give us just a flavor of that, too, if you would, Hans.
Well, again, it turned out that a high-up official, a guy named Bruce Orr, who was just a couple of doors down from and underneath Rosenstein, not only did he meet with Christopher Steele, the guy who put together the infamous Steele dossier, but Orr's wife was working for Glenn Simpson's firm, the firm that contracted with Steele that was being paid by the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, she was helping write the Steele dossier, as best I can tell. So neither of these were things that Rosenstein was aware of? Can you believe that?
No, it's very hard for me to believe. It reminds me of the line in the IG report that was recently released where James Comey said that he didn't understand the significance of the emails found on the laptop of Anthony Weiner because he didn't realize that Anthony Weiner was married to Huma Abedin, one of Hillary Clinton's top aides, which, you know, maybe an ordinary member of the public might not know that, but the head of the FBI claiming he didn't know that's astonishing.
Okay, well, switching gears, there was a vote in the House yesterday that it seems is putting the Department of Justice and FBI on notice that they're going to get into some serious jeopardy in terms of contempt of Congress. There was a lot of contempt being expressed, I think it's fair to say, yesterday by these guys. But tell us a little bit about that and its implications.
Well, you know, all along throughout the past year, I think it's been almost a year, the House Intelligence Committee has been investigating the Justice Department and the FBI's possible mishandling of the Trump collusion investigation. And throughout this time, the DOJ and FBI have been doing everything they can to stall, to not turn over documents. When they finally turn over documents, they have so many redactions that you can't tell what is in the documents. And all of this, by the way, people should understand, the Justice Department doesn't have a right to do this. First of all, they can't claim, well, it's classified material because this is the House Intelligence Committee.
They actually have a handling of a lot of it, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And second, DOJ doesn't have any kind of lawyer or legal privilege it can claim, like attorney-client privilege, to keep these documents from going because the only privilege that is recognized by the courts that protects any kind of documents held by the Justice Department is executive privilege. That's if the president asserts executive privilege. That, of course, hasn't been done. So what's happened is House Republicans passed a resolution insisting that DOJ comply with the document requests that have been made. And the next step will be if Rosenstein and Chris Wray refuse to turn over FBI and DOJ documents, as I have no doubt, they'll probably be held in contempt.
Yeah, well, within 7 days, I think, is the deadline. Let me turn to one related subject. There was testimony provided behind closed doors, I guess in the form of a deposition, for hours and hours and hours this week by Peter Strzok, one of the DOJ, FBI, specifically personnel implicated in much of this skullduggery. What, if anything, do we know about that other than it was a trial by fire?
We don't really know what he said, but we do know one thing. And again, this relates to our prior issue that we were just talking about. Apparently, members who were there came out and complained about the fact that the FBI had sent FBI lawyers in with Strzok, who repeatedly told him not to answer questions. So once again, the FBI is doing everything it can, apparently, to cover up what happened instead of fully cooperating with a congressional committee.
Yeah, well, we'll watch this closely and have you back hopefully next week to give us an update. Peter Strzok is one kettle of fish, as are the others we've been discussing. Let me turn to something else you've focused on this week in the Heritage website, Hans, and that is what I think of as kind of separation anxiety. It has been much in the news, of course, in connection with immigration law enforcement. Tell us what you make of the state of play at the moment, the president's executive order on the subject, the defeat of the Ryan amnesty bill, and sort of where we are at this point on all of that.
Well, thank goodness the amnesty bill was defeated. It was a very bad idea. It would have provided amnesty for between 1.8 and 2.4 million illegal aliens, and was missing many of the steps that need to be taken to increase security along the border and to enhance interior enforcement. So thank goodness it got defeated. What has bugged me about all the vitriolic protests and criticism of the president over this family separation issue is that the ignorance displayed by the media and others, they're blaming all this on Trump. They ignore the fact that the person to really blame for this is Bill Clinton. And I know people have a hard time believing that, but actually the reason that juvenile aliens can't be kept with their parents when their parents are being detained because they're going to be prosecuted for illegally crossing the border is because in the 1990s, when the government was sued over the detention of juvenile aliens, Bill Clinton's administration, Janet Reno, the Attorney General, instead of fighting the lawsuit, they agreed to settle it. And in the settlement, they said, this is called the Flores Settlement, if anybody wants to Google it, the government said, okay, we won't hold juvenile aliens for more than 20 days. After that, we will place them with another family member who's in the U.S., if there is one, with a legal guardian, or they will be turned over to the Department of Health and Human Services, which then puts them in some kind of foster care system. This was followed by the George Bush administration. It was followed by the Obama administration, and it's being followed by the Trump administration. But only now, suddenly,
is it a problem? It seems a little cynical, I have to say. But there's a lot of that going on at the moment, including the caviling. And just very quickly on this, if I could, because I did want to ask you about the Supreme Court as well, Hans. This sudden boomlet behind the idea that what we need to do in face of all these problems is get rid of those people who are enforcing the law, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement team at ICE. Your thoughts on that quickly?
That is the craziest thing that I have ever heard. I mean, that's like saying, if you're living in the city of New York, you know, we just don't want a police force anymore, and we're going to get rid of it.
Well, we've got too much crime, and the problem really is that people are busting all these criminals, so let's stop that. This is insanity. Okay, Hans, quickly, because we are going to run out of time, having stipulated to insanity and cynicism, what do we make of the current thrashing going on the part of the Democrats about the president's constitutional duty to pick a new Supreme Court nominee to replace Justice Kennedy? And if you want to give us a quick burst on his legacy, I'd appreciate that too.
Well, his legacy reminds me of the famous Clint Eastwood movie, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Look, he's been on the correct side with the conservative justices on many cases involving upholding First Amendment rights, upholding Second Amendment rights. He was one of the justices who voted against Obamacare. On the other hand, he's been on the bad side in many cases involving what I would call politically correct social issues, you know, gay marriage, abortion. He was the unfortunate author with the liberals of the Boumediene versus Bush decision. That's the decision that said that enemy combatants, you know, jihadist terrorists, that we capture abroad who are waging war on the United States have a right to habeas corpus, which means they have a right to contest their capture in federal court. We have never, ever extended that constitutional right to foreign aliens, and particularly not people waging war against us. So again, bad decision. So the president has the ability to now put in somebody who will be consistently a good conservative on the court.
And the left has gone simply stark raving mad about this, it sounds like. And I'm imagining we're going to see a lot more high drama on that front before we're through. Hans, we'll have to come back to you for further updates on that too, though, if we may. In the meantime, thank you so much for your time today and for the great work you do at the Heritage Foundation and elsewhere. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll look forward to visiting with you in the near future. We're going to talk next to one of your colleagues at Heritage, as a matter of fact, Dakota Woods, about the practice of peace through strength, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a very great pleasure to say we are joined once again by a man we've admired greatly for a long time, but haven't spoken to for altogether too long a time. He is Dakota Woods. He is Senior Research Fellow specializing in defense programs at the Center for National Defense of the Heritage Foundation, nestled in its Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy. He brings to his work there, which includes, among other things, editing an extraordinarily important resource, the Index of U.S. Military Power, which we're breathlessly waiting an update to in October, I'm told. But he has a wealth of experience by virtue of his 20 years in uniform, rising through the ranks in the United States Marine Corps to a lieutenant colonel, and in the course of all of that, doing some incredibly important work, planning and executing operations, enduring and Iraqi freedom, among other things. A planner, a strategist, and a very good man. So good to have you back, Dakota. Thank you for taking a few minutes.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Good. Well, let me talk to you first and foremost about something I know you've been tracking closely, because at the end of the day, it's what's going to add capability to the kind of strategy that you've been recommending the president has largely embraced, and I believe can best be described as peace through strength. Specifically, I'm talking about the annual National Defense Authorization Act working its way through the Congress at the moment. Dakota, how would you characterize what Congress is up to, and what do you think will come out of the end of that sausage-making operation?
Well, I think it's the way they've structured it, and there are some differences between the House and the Senate version, but in general, I think it captures the sense of Congress that things have not been good for the military, and that the decline in readiness, aging of equipment, and all really need to be addressed. So even in this midst of all the political turmoil and mounting national debt, annual deficits, it's become such an issue for the military that they're using this NDAA to try to address that. So a bit more funding, increase in strength, a bit more in research and development. So it's a good step in the right direction. The challenge is, will they be able to continue that beyond 2019?
Now, the president continues to talk about not just a bit more funding, but the most funding ever in our history. I'm not sure if that's literally true with all the World War II funding and all that, but still, an awful lot of money is being invested at the moment. You mentioned force structure, you mentioned readiness, you mentioned research and development. Given, as we've talked about over the years, Dakota, the hole we managed to get ourselves into, particularly during the Obama years, what I consider to be a wrecking operation of our military, how adequate is what's being done to the task of rebuilding to a point where we actually can hopefully achieve peace through strength?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a step along a very long path. And you know, we want to, I think, always cheer on these steps, but by no means does this solve the problem. And to your point about damage that's been done over the years, it actually stretches back to the end of the Cold War. So this is a hole that the country's been digging for over a quarter of a century. You know, remember at the end of that 90s, the Clinton administration just dramatically slashed, you know, the Sovietologists, which should have been shifted over to, you know, Chinese-speaking analysts and all that. That didn't happen. We shrank in our Army active component from 780,000 soldiers in uniform, which allowed us to have a presence in Europe and Korea and other places, as well as rotational training and making sure folks are ready, 780,000 down to 480,000. In 2012, the Army was in the process of rebuilding capacity because of the sustained operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were trying to get to 48 brigades. They only got to 45, and then Budget Control Act came in. Now they're down to 31. So 45 down to 31. Now, those brigades are beefier. You know, they've got more combat engineers and intelligence support and those kinds of things, so they're more capable. But they're still, you know, units. So you only have 31 units that can be deployed and put places instead of a larger number, which eases the burden.
And how would you characterize the readiness of those 31? I've heard some horror stories that it's down in single digits that are really ready to go. Is that still correct?
It is. I mean, they've made some progress with the additional funding last year and then going into 2019, you know, the additional funding they're looking for. So at one time, a year ago, the Chief of Staff of the Army said of our 31 brigades, we assess about 10 of them are at an acceptable level of readiness, and only three of those would actually be in a ready-to-deploy or fight-tonight condition. So they say that they're up to about half, so maybe 15 of 30 are at acceptable levels of readiness. They're trying to push more through the training cycle, but that's going to be limited by how much ammo you can shoot, which is driven by money. How many people do you have? How do you cover down on operational requirements, folks going to schools, going through that training cycle without really breaking the force? And so it's a fine line that Secretary Mattis and the services are walking on that. And all the resources they are getting, they're trying to rebuild some readiness, but at the expense also of growing the force.
Yeah, and modernizing it too, which is another thing I wanted to turn to with you. We've got a summit coming up with Vladimir Putin and President Trump July 16th, as you know. It's in the context, inevitably, of a yawning disparity between the kind of modernization that the Russians have been doing specifically with respect to their nuclear forces and the programs on our side that are years behind and pretty paltry by comparison. Dakota, as a guy who thinks about grand strategy as well as, you know, the mechanics of implementation of it, what do you make of that disparity, and how might it color that summit, do you think?
Well, you know, our major competitors, Russia being one, China's another, you know, they do counting as well. Everybody has access to the military power index published by IISS that really looks at the forces that countries have. They know when equipment was entered into service, they look at how we're using it. So, for instance, our F-16 will beat just about every other airplane out there, but it's built for only so many flight hours. So even though it's a good plane, if you're continuing to fly orbits over Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, you're using up the lifespan of that item. You know, so are we bringing in new equipment as good or better to offset our rapid aging of good equipment? And folks like Vladimir Putin and his analysts look at those sorts of things. On the nuclear enterprise, they're plowing all kinds of money into developing new types of weapons, better understanding, usability across a range of yields. The United States is working under a self-imposed moratorium that prevents any kind of yield-producing experiments since the early 1990s. I think 1992 was the last time we actually detonated something. And so this old knowledge, we try to replicate in computer models that give us some assurance that things are supposed to operate, you know, as they will. That's not proven. I mean, it's mathematically shown, but you actually haven't done something in the real world.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Dakota, told me a story about that. The fellow was responsible at the time for our nuclear weapons test site. And he said that one of his bright young scientists came to him one day and said, "I really hate experimentation because it interferes with my calculations."
Yeah, that real-world data just kind of messes up my formula, right?
It does. Hey, let me turn quickly to one last item on the agenda. Dakota, we could talk for days, and I hope we'll get you back soon for a full hour. It's been too long. But one of the other initiatives that, as you know, President Trump unveiled somewhat serendipitously and spontaneously the other day is the idea of a space force. And he seemed to be signaling that he intended to have that be a sixth service. A, what do you think of that idea? And B, is that in fact what's in train, or is that being sabotaged by people in the Defense Department who don't want that new entity to be carved out of the Air Force?
Well, here at our organization, Heritage, we're both against it and for it. How can that be the case? We were against the original idea when it was brought up in Congress, because there are about 60 agencies that have something to do with space capabilities. The U.S. Air Force only controls three of those. So to carve out the space piece of the U.S. Air Force and then say that that's going to be our space force and we'll be much better off, you're not doing really anything to address the enterprise, and yet you're laying on another layer of bureaucracy that, you know, a headquarters element and all the things that go along with having a military service. So if you're going to do that, you got to go big. You got to take all of the various stakeholders, put them under a single flag, and really deal with the totality of space.
Meaning the rest of those agencies and components of agencies that would be subsumed under this new element.
Yeah, the other 57.
Now, does that include NASA, or does that not include NASA? How did you look at that?
It does, and it includes the intelligence community and other elements, ballistic missile defense. Anybody that deals with something that gets put up into orbit, you know, how are you controlling it, tasking it, what service is it providing? And so we recognize that space is an actual legitimate warfighting domain itself, as well as a domain that supports the other domains, land and sea and air operations. So it's very important. We're all in favor of dealing with that in its totality, but you can't piecemeal it.
Yeah. This was a daunting proposition, I think, even if you're just fighting the Air Force for its rice bowl. Is that what the president has in mind, do you think, or is that something that is bureaucratically just insuperably hard?
Well, he and his staff have recognized the importance. He says, look, if we're going to be serious about this relative to China and Russia and others, then we've got to do something. So he's mandated a study, and everybody hates studies, but, you know, trying to get your arms around a domain where you have 60 players, they need to figure this out. So he's issued the marching orders. Secretary of Defense is saluted. We'll figure out what needs to be done, and they'll report back with an actionable plan.
Dakota Wood, thank you so much for your time today. Lieutenant Colonel Wood, it's always a pleasure to talk with you and learn much from you. I hope we'll have a chance to do it again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Mary Fanning about Gulftainer right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Mary Fanning, an investigative journalist of considerable ability and with some important accomplishments to her credit. With her partner, Alan Jones, she has been doing simply incalculably important work, exposing a problem that I'm pleased to say we've been helping publish and promote her concerns about, involving a company called Gulftainer. And she's here with us to talk about it. She has, among other accomplishments, been a co-founder with General Paul Vallely of the Coalition of Concerned Citizens. She has been published at Breitbart and The Washington Times, Tom Digi, and LifeZet, Laura Ingraham's web platform, and her own very important blog, AmericanReport.org. Mary Fanning, welcome back. It is very, very good to have you, though it's not under the happiest of circumstances. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Frank. Yes, it is nice to be back with you. We have things happening with our ports. They just announced that they were handing over Port of Wilmington without a CFIUS review.
Well, before we get into that, let's just stop and back up the lens a little bit. The company we're talking about is known as Gulftainer. And you have been tracking its activities for some time, notably in connection with a port that it is currently operating, Port Canaveral in Florida. Tell us a little bit about that facility, first of all, Mary Fanning, and then let's talk about who owns Gulftainer and what kinds of things has it been up to?
Well, Port Canaveral is certainly critical infrastructure. It sits beside NASA, where our space program resides, but it's also where our Trident turning basin, our nuclear submarines are. In fact, Gulftainer is placed at their cargo container operations 1,000 feet from our Trident submarines.
That would be a strategic problem, I would think, of the first order, if there's a problem with Gulftainer. And you've persuasively argued, including in an important occasional paper we published entitled The Perfect Storm, that there is reason to be very concerned from a security perspective about Gulftainer. Tell us why, Mary Fanning.
A couple of reasons. Gulftainer is owned in part by Hamid Jaffer. He partnered with the Emir of Sharjah, Al-Qasimi. However, they did not reveal the true ownership when they received the 35-year lease. They received that lease without the benefit of a CFIUS national security review. Hamid Jaffer was investigated by our Treasury Department and three congressional committees for his oil for superweapons scheme. Dr. Jaffer is his brother. Dr. Jaffer, via Jaffer, was Saddam Hussein's nuclear mastermind. The oil for superweapons scheme was to fund Saddam and Dr. Jaffer's WMD program. That's of great concern.
The Jaffer family is an Iraqi, prominent Iraqi family, as you say, very deeply tied into some of Saddam Hussein's most ominous activities. So, Mary Fanning, you're telling me that a company that is partly owned by people who were all about building weapons of mass destruction, among other purposes, for presumably use against us, or at least certainly our friends and interests in the Middle East, is now controlling the port of Port Canaveral without a review by the government agency, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, that's supposed to prevent this sort of thing. Now, tell us about what they're doing with respect to this other port in Wilmington, Delaware.
In Wilmington, it's not just a 35-year lease. They have a 50-year lease, not just for the cargo container, but to the entire port. So they've come in and they're receiving a 50-year lease to Port of Wilmington. Port of Wilmington is in close proximity to Washington, Philadelphia, and New York.
Certainly within cruise missile range, which is of importance because one of the other very alarming factors about this so-called Gulftainer company is its partner in a joint venture. Tell us about that.
The Jaffer family and their company, Gulftainer, is in a joint venture with Rostec. Rostec is a Russian state-owned weapons company. Rostec wholly owns Rosoboron Export. Rosoboron Export is the company that exports the Club K. The Club K is a Trojan horse weapon system that delivers caliber missiles that can either be tipped with nuclear, EMP, chemical, biological, or a standard payload.
Let me just interrupt you for 1 second because there's something important that I don't think you said. The Club K-4 cruise missile launcher is concealed in a what seems from the outside to be a standard shipping container of the kind that would be brought in by the millions into ports like these over the years. Is that right?
Absolutely. It appears to be a standard intermodal cargo container. It is then put on ships, trains, trucks, and taken to every hamlet in America. This is of particular concern because under the Obama administration, though Congress mandated 100% of cargo containers must be inspected, they brought it down to less than 2% to be inspected. And having spoken recently to someone who was in charge of Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, Dr. Joseph King, he says that less than 0.1% of cargo containers are being inspected.
It's trivially small. So just to recap, Mary Fanning, we have a company that is owned in part by the family that was involved extensively with trying to help Saddam Hussein get weapons of mass destruction, and that is in a partnership with a Russian company that manufactures delivery systems for such weapons, covertly, stealthily, Trojan horse-wise, if you will, is now running not just one, but imminently two of our major ports. I understand, Mary, that they are also, Gulftainer, anticipating that they will now be able to get to control still other ports in this country. Is that right?
There are 42 other ports on the boards right now that went before CFIUS for approval. We don't know where those stand at this point.
42 ports that Gulftainer wants to manage in the United States, or that others are also bidding for?
Other U.S. ports.
That Gulftainer itself is hoping to take over these kind of leases for?
That's correct.
My God. So, Mary, quickly, what has the United States government been doing to ensure that what seems on the face of it to be an extraordinarily dangerous thing is carefully examined, vetted for its national security implications, and presumably thereby blocked?
Well, President Trump did something, and he put sanctions on the Russell Bourne export, which one would think would stop Gulftainer from achieving this 50-year lease at Port of Wilmington and Port Canaveral. However, it did not go through the full CFIUS process. The CFIUS process was bypassed for the first port deal at Port Canaveral by Ayman Nabi Mir. Ayman Nabi Mir was the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Investment at Treasury. He has now been replaced. The last few weeks, Ayman Mir stepped down, and now someone else has moved into that place, a man named Thomas Feddo, F-E-D-D-O. He previously worked at OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control.
During the Obama administration.
During the Obama administration, beginning in 2009, he came in and said that this deal does not need a CFIUS review.
So we're almost out of time, but very quickly, how could that possibly be? How, knowing what you know, knowing what you and Alan Jones have reported over these past, well, year and some, how could it possibly be that anybody with a lick of sense, let alone with serious national security responsibilities in the United States government, wouldn't see this kind of deal with this kind of company, with its kind of partners, isn't something that rises to the first order of national security concerns in this space?
This is an obvious national security threat. If we do not manage our own ports, our own national security, we will not remain a sovereign nation. We will not direct our own destiny. This is a very dangerous deal. The idea of handing people who have been involved in terrorism U.S. ports is beyond, as Barack Obama likes to say, boneheaded.
It is beyond boneheaded. Mary Fanning, we have to leave it at that. We'll be coming back to you, though, for follow-ups on this. You can count on it. Check out Mary Fanning's work at AmericanReport.org and also at SecureFreedom.org. Mary, thank you so much for what you and Alan Jones do. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll look forward to talking with you in the near future. I hope we'll have a chance to talk to the rest of you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.